At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams, whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Welcome to another episode of Behind the Knife. Our guest on this episode is Dr. Thomas White, a trauma and critical care surgeon who practices at the Intermountain Medical Center in Salt Lake City, Utah. He's on the board of directors of the newly formed Chest Wall Injury Society, and he's actually dabbled in podcasts as part of the society's Ribcast. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. White.
Well, thank you very much. It's my pleasure to be here.
So we like to start our podcast with getting an introduction about who you are, where you're from, and how did you take the path into doing trauma and participating in the society?
Well, sure. Well, as you mentioned, I'm in Salt Lake City now, but I haven't always been here. I started practicing in rural Wyoming after my general surgery training at the University of Utah. I was there for a brief period of time, and then I went to I traveled east and set up shop in Scotts Bluff, Nebraska, also a rural community, but a bigger one. And I had a very busy general surgery practice there. I was somewhat roped into the trauma directorship job there. We were a level two trauma center, and I rapidly developed a passion for trauma care and critical care. And about a dozen years ago, I decided that I wanted to take it to the next level. I went back and did a critical care fellowship at the advanced age of 47. That's a whole other topic. And survived that, and then joined the trauma group at the newly established Intermountain Medical Center, which is the flagship hospital for the Intermountain Healthcare group of hospitals here in Salt Lake City. So we are a level one trauma center. I'm one of the rank and file trauma critical care surgeons, and I do some acute care surgery, but my primary focus is trauma care.
So Dr. White, how did the idea of the Chest Wall Injury Society come about?
Well, about 4 years ago, I had a notion that there were enough surgeons who were doing chest wall injury repair on a regular basis. There was a critical mass, enough that we could get together and start sharing ideas, research initiatives, that sort of thing. We were operating principally in silos, and I thought it was time maybe to see if there was a way to reach some common ground. We, with the help of Intermountain Healthcare and some others, we organized the first rib fixation colloquium. That was in Park City in the spring of 2016. That's Park City, Utah. So that was just a little over two and a half years ago. It seemed like a very successful enterprise. We had about 60 surgeons from multiple countries and throughout the United States there, and we promised to meet and do it again, and we did that in 2017. And after that meeting, we formalized the idea or the plan of forming a society. That came to fruition shortly after that meeting, and the society gained ownership or became the principal driver for the ongoing meetings. And our last our most recent and third summit meeting was just this last spring. And that was the first meeting fully under the guise or under the auspice of the Chest Wall Injury Society. We now have about 140 members from 17 different countries. And we're experiencing steady growth and a lot of enthusiasm. And our initial idea that there was a group of surgeons out there who needed to form a tribe and start interacting formally and informally came to being.
So let's jump right into our dissection of the day. One of the things we like to do is talk a little bit more about an in-depth with our guests. And today we're going to talk a little bit about managing chest wall trauma. So walk our listeners a little bit through chest wall trauma. What's your thoughts about going into them? What have been the major changes in management over the past few years?
Certainly. Well, as everyone knows or should know that's involved with trauma care, it's one of the most common and morbid conditions that we deal with. Until recently, rib fractures, multiple rib fractures, that's the primary injury pattern that we see, or the most common injury pattern we see in patients with blunt chest trauma. They've been managed expectantly. And most of the time you get away with that. But there is a subgroup of patients whose injuries are so severe, the mechanical disruption of their bony and muscular rib breathing apparatus is so severe that they simply can't support themselves without mechanical support, and now more commonly with surgical support. The history of rib fracture repair is an interesting one. There was some enthusiasm for it a few decades ago with some success, but then with the advent of and widespread availability of the mechanical ventilator, the motivation to further develop mechanical repairs of the chest wall sort of went away for a while. Internal splinting with the mechanical ventilator became the norm. About 15 years ago, mid-90s, late 90s, there were reports began to surface in the literature of operative fixation of severe flail chest with positive results. And that led to development of rib-specific plating systems in the decade of the 2000s. And those became available to most surgeons who wanted to get their hands on them around 2009, 2010. And there's been an exponential increase in interest and in publications in the literature and the number of patients who've been treated with operative fixation since that time period. So the modern era of rib fixation is a decade old or a little older. And we're really still very much in the infancy of the application, the technology, and most importantly, the science of repair. There are other chest wall injuries that are import, sternal fracture, for example, scapular fractures, diaphragm injuries, and those are the interest in those injuries is also escalating. But the primary interest in the last decade or so has been in rib fracture repair in patients with flail chest mechanics.
So, Dr. White, talking a little bit more about that, about the surgical management of rib fractures, how do you decide who and when to plate?
Well, that's the really challenging question, particularly for those who haven't developed a lot of experience with the technique yet. Finding that ideal patient and making sure that you're applying it to the right patient and you're not performing too much surgery on someone, that can be challenging. We don't have currently, I think it's safe to say that the literature supports its use in the patient with flail chest. Of course, just to review, that's the patient with rib fractures that are rib fracture pattern that involves multiple fractures over a period of several ribs, creating a a plate or a mantle of chest wall that moves independently from the rest of the chest wall. And that independent motion or that paradoxical motion causes extreme embarrassment of respiratory mechanics in patients and significant pain, both of those leading ultimately in many patients to respiratory failure and the need for mechanical ventilation, then ultimately tracheostomy, prolonged hospitalization, pneumonia, and some element of mortality in that group. So I think it was a recognition that there was a patient group with bad chest trauma who wasn't being adequately treated or adequately served with our current technology, and a drive and a motivation to do something for those patients to save them from the perils of the standard therapy. And right now that patient group has been studied with a handful of randomized prospective trials that have been positive. And so the data there is, and the recommendations from the several trauma groups that are positive in that regard. I think the bigger challenge, which is the question I think you were trying to ask me or were asking me, was what do we do with patients with a lesser degree of injury where the indications aren't and the benefits may not be as apparent? How do we decide whether those patients deserve an operation? And it's not a terribly gratifying answer that I'm going to give you. It's based on expert opinion and clinical experience, but there is some data that patients with severe rib fractures, multiple displaced rib fractures, benefit significantly from fixation, particularly early fixation, and one can significantly reduce their length of stay, pneumonia rates, and ultimately impact their ability to return to work, which is really or whatever they do, which is really that has eluded us, but really needs to be studied. And that is how, if you fix somebody with bad rib fractures, who's going to live anyway, but you fix them, if you fix them up front, are you enhancing their ability to get back to their pre-morbid or pre-injury lifestyle? Are you able to avoid narcotics and narcotic addiction? Are you able to improve their and lower their risk of chronic pain syndromes? Those are the kinds of questions that we really need answers to, and some of those studies are now ongoing. We can talk about at least one of those studies specifically if you'd like.
Yeah, I guess what I'm most interested in is that there seems to be kind of two schools of thought, specifically when it comes to early rib plating, and especially like in young patients, if that has a benefit of plating early. I know some people believe really strongly that you should plate early and others believe that you should not. So I was just kind of wondering what your practice was, where we stand currently with the literature, yeah. And what your experience has been with that.
Well, the best paper in the literature that tries to answer that question was published in the Journal of Trauma, and it's from 2015. It was a plenary paper at the AAST. It's a multi-institutional look at timing of fixation. Our institution was involved along with three others, and we looked at approximately 600 patients and looked at the timing of repair and compared that to things like length of stay, ICU length of stay, ventilator days, those sorts of things. And it appeared that patients who got earlier repair did better. It didn't appear that way. In fact, statistically, they did better. And the rationale or the idea here is that if you're fixing them early before they, quote, fail, unquote, then you're lowering their risk or eliminating their need for the complications that ensue that we talked about a few moments ago. So the one school of thought, as you referred to, is fix early, avoid complications, and get patients out of the hospital quicker and safer. The other school of thought as well, because we're not entirely our ability to predict who's going to need this operation or do well or do poorly without it, I guess is the best way to say that. Because our prediction tools in that regard are imperfect, then we should wait and let patients fail or start to fail and then offer repair. And I think that this study, along with some of the other data that's available, I think shows a strong signal that you should use your best predictive powers and fix those patients with severe injury and eliminate some of the complications. So right now in our institution and many others, early fixation is the order of the day. And when I say early, I mean 24 to 48 hours is sort of what we would consider to be early. It's how we defined it in this study as well, retrospectively. We occasionally will fix patients inside of 24 hours. It's the rare patient, but it's a patient with obvious anatomic derangement who's going to fail, and their all of their other traumatic injuries are evident and addressed, and the patient is not no longer needing active resuscitation. That there is a rare patient like that who deserves to go to the operating room, I think, quickly, either the night of injury or perhaps the next morning. We do a lot of our surgeries the day after their injury. We let the dust settle a bit. We make sure that they don't have ongoing needs and they don't have any significant contraindications to surgical fixation. But that's an evolution. When we first started doing this, we waited to see how patients would do because we weren't confident we could predict who would do poorly. And with time, I think we got better at that prediction. And so our time to surgery from injury to OR progressively declined. And now it's in that 24 to 48 hour window is our average time for fixation. I think that's true in most centers that do a fair number of repairs.
So another kind of follow-up question I had, at our institution, I think we're participating in one of your rib plating trials, and we get a lot of elderly patients, and we, you know, keep them in the step down unit or the ICU for close care and watch their lung expansion. But I guess on the flip side of talking about, you know, younger patients, do you have exclusion criteria for older patients, or is it all just based on, you know, what their comorbidities are and if you feel like they're going to have success after rib plating?
That's an excellent question. Do we exclude patients from consideration if they have certain comorbidities or certain age restrictions and that sort of thing? And I think the bottom line really is no, as a short answer. This is not only true in rib fixation surgery, but it's true in many areas of trauma care. And it's the patients who have, are at the extremes of age, particularly the elderly extreme of age, and those who have marginal reserve and have comorbidities, those patients tolerate complications poorly or not at all. And although there's some reluctance, or early, at least early on, we had some reluctance taking an 85-year-old to the operating room to fix their brittle ribs. What we found was that they tolerated that procedure very well with low risks and low morbidity, and they tended to do well. But if they're left alone to develop atelectasis and then pneumonia and then intubation and then most of the time those patients did very poorly and many of them didn't survive. So that's not well defined yet in the literature, but I think most of us who are doing this on a fairly regular basis do not shy away from the frail patient. Now, certainly if someone's at the end of life or they have metastatic cancer or they or their family are not motivated to weather the storm, so to speak, of recovering from their traumatic injury, then those patients should not be fixed. But if you're going to give them a chance, you want to give them their best chance of recovery. I think early and aggressive fixation is probably very prudent in the frail patient. We found bone density to be a concern. The ribs are very fragile compared to other long bones, and there are mechanical issues that are important to take into account when you're fixing the ribs of the elderly or the osteoporotic. But in general, those patients, in my experience, don't stress their repairs very much. And so the fixation tends to hold if you're careful and do it right. And on balance, they do okay with repair.
Dr. White, I wanted to ask you probably a very obvious question that I'm sure you get asked a lot in all these organization meetings. How do you justify the cost of replating? A lot of trauma centers, you know, deal with uninsured people and when you talk to that school of surgeons that do not believe in replating, or added benefits of replating, I should say, they talk about the costs a lot. I wanted to get your opinion on, like, how do you justify the cost of this this procedure?
Well, yes, they do. It's a very popular and common comment about rib fracture repair. I think some of it's justified. I think some of it is unjustified. The problem with it is we don't have good way to measure true costs, particularly in the non-operative setting. So let's say you leave someone unrepaired and they develop respiratory failure that's short-lived, but they're on the ventilator for a couple of days and they spend those days in the ICU, and they might develop a pneumonia or a CLABSI or a blood clot, and they eventually get well and they go to rehab, and they may or may not have had to go to rehab if they've been repaired. And that patient ends up costing whoever, the hospital or third party payer or something, that that costly recovery costs someone something. But how do you directly identify those costs and compare them with the surgical costs? That's a real challenge, and I've not seen anybody do that very effectively yet. But that's the issue that we're talking about. I think if you're going to make a case to someone for doing rib repair, to justify the upfront cost, you have to know sort of what downstream cost you're avoiding by preventing infections and prolonged hospitalizations. So that, again, not a terribly gratifying answer. We don't have a lot of data on that yet, but I think all of those who've done this have seen that, seen those patients who do poorly, and how much, you know, and have an appreciation for how expensive that course of action is. The one thing that we don't know, the other rationale, I think, for it's reasonable, again, without a lot of data, for those who are opponents, is what are these patients, what do they look like, and what are they doing 6 to 12 months postoperatively? What we do know from some studies by Lander, Casper, and others is that patients with flail chest who don't get surgery, and this data comes from the 90s and 2000s before rib fracture repair was common, the patients who have flail chest, only a minority of those patients really ever get back to their full function, and a small minority, actually, less than 40% of those patients achieve normalcy again. And many of them have chronic pain issues and chest wall deformity and infirmities that are hard to characterize. And how do you what's the cost of that? We don't know. We don't have good data on that. But that's it seems to me, in the absence of good data, that if we have a technology that's well tolerated and appears to be very effective in reducing these complications and these long term conditions I just referred to, that perhaps we ought to give the patient the benefit of the doubt and give them an opportunity. Now, that's not very scientific. We obviously should be studying these patients in a randomized format, but those trials are extremely hard to pull off and to accomplish. And so in the absence of that data, or until that data is available, I think one can justify the expensive surgical costs by pointing out that you're eliminating or reducing significantly the very expensive downstream costs from patients with bad rib fractures who don't get repaired. And we have historical data on that.
Okay, let's transition now to our tips and tricks segment, where we ask our experts to give us some helpful hints to get us out of sticky situations. And based on what we were just talking about, let's talk about the patient with flail chest. Can you give our listening audience a few tips and tricks about how do you deal with that particular patient? When do you decide to manage non-operatively? When do you bring in an epidural? When do you intubate? When do you do rib plating? What is your kind of very quick algorithm in terms of dealing with this this patient population?
Well, that's a very well-informed question. It's and it's complex. We could spend hours talking about all of those things. But in a nutshell, I think the first thing to do is identify these patients when they arrive, because that's your best opportunity to get to get imaging, adequate imaging, and to go ahead and obtain 3D reconstructions of their CAT scan, which I think are very helpful. I'm not going to say that it's an imperative, but we're reluctant to take anyone to the operating room without an opportunity to look at the 3D reformatting of their ribs. It really helps with operative planning. It gives you an opportunity to visualize the mechanical disruption and how you're going to repair that and which fractures you're going to seek out to repair. And it also helps very much in educating the family and the patient about the need or the rationale for an operation of their ribs, which I really don't think can be overstated. You need their buy-in and good chest imaging with 3D reconstructions helps you in that regard. So that's the most important thing. Secondly, you got to make sure the patient doesn't have another reason or have a reason not to be in the operating room for that 2 or 3 hour repair. Are they unstable from hemodynamics? Do they have a spleen injury that's bleeding? Do they have a TBI that really deserves to be observed and treated medically and optimally in a non-prone or non-supine position for a while? I mean, these are the kinds of questions you need to ask yourself. Is the spine stable? Do they have an unstable spine or pelvis fracture that needs to be addressed first? So those kinds of conditions. And then you need if they have flail chest, in our algorithm, they are candidates for rib repair. It doesn't mean every one of them gets fixed. Once in a while, you'll meet a patient with flail chest anatomically or radiographically who clinically is doing very well. Their ribs are not badly displaced, so you're not terribly concerned about implosion or collapse of the chest wall, which can occur. And so you might choose to treat that patient non-operatively, and that's not rare. So you need to, obviously you need to look at the patient and see if they're in respiratory distress. You might use an objective measure, spirometry or some sort of PFT testing to see how they're doing. And then and obviously you want to optimize their pain control before you assess them or use residual pain or persistent pain as a criteria for operating. So that's a combination of opioids and non-steroidals and in select patients, epidural catheters or paravertebral blocks or transdermal lidocaine, those sorts of adjuncts are now commonly used. One thing rib fracture repair has done for us and for many is it's improved the way we take care of all patients with chest wall injury. You know, when we started this a decade ago, I don't remember doing anything except giving patients a bucket load of opioids and an occasional epidural. And now everybody gets these adjuncts and the multimodality approach. And I think whether they get surgery or they don't get surgery, they get better care now for their rib fractures. So I think that's a side benefit of aggressively looking at rib fracture repairs, that the patients who don't get repaired, and there are many, they'll get better therapy. There's a feeling out there that once you start plating ribs that you're going to fix everybody. And we've looked carefully at that. And the last time we looked in the 2014-2016 time period, we were repairing only 11% of patients who admitted to our service with rib fractures. So it's 1 out of 10 patients on the trauma service who get an operation. It's not everyone, but I think everybody benefits from that. So operative considerations, you really need to think carefully about how you're going to position the patient. Oftentimes it's a lateral decubitus position. That's sort of the workhorse default positioning, but sometimes it's prone and sometimes it's supine. It depends depends entirely on the fracture pattern. We used to make big thoracotomy, posterior lateral thoracotomy incisions on all these patients and expose them widely. And that's evolution towards more precision incision placement and minimizing exposure and sparing muscle has been a very gratifying part of this journey. We now seek to make incisions as small as possible, not compromising exposure, of course, but making them small enough that they heal, they're cosmetically less conspicuous and they there's fewer complications, that sort of thing. We don't divide muscle routinely. The latissimus and the serratus can be moved out of the way or split to expose the underlying ribs. We frequently go under the scapula now through the triangle of auscultation. And with the modern plating systems, all of them have right angle, low profile instruments that allow you to place these plates high and anterior and posterior from a distance without having to expose directly over the top of them for right angle or for direct orientation. So the systems have the companies are partnering with surgeons to make this procedure less invasive as we move forward. So operative considerations, are you going to do one side or both sides? Are you going to fix every rib? There are occasions when we do both sides. Usually I stage my bilateral repairs. I pick the worst side first and do the next one the next day, but occasionally we'll do one side and flip the patient and do the other. We don't fix every rib fracture. Fractures that are non-displaced, and particularly if they're of ribs 1 or 2 or 10, 11, 12, we generally leave those alone. They have they contribute very little to respiratory mechanics. They're not as painful. And so we focus on ribs 3 through 9. We don't repair fractures that are close to the spine. How close is too close has changed. But if you need a sufficient zone of rib next to the spine to land your hardware. And at a minimum, that's about 3 or 4 centimeters. So some of those fracture patterns right along the spinous process or close to the transverse process, those fractures are some that we oftentimes will ignore. The cartilage fractures, parasternal fractures, that's an area of controversy, but more and more often now we are plating to or over cartilage to try to stabilize the anterior chest wall. We frequently see patients with sternal flail referred to us now, or we see them primarily from seatbelt, from steering wheel impacts, from CPR. Those are the two most common mechanisms, and we now have techniques and plating systems that allow us to bridge or stabilize those flail segments with a high degree of success. You plate what you can get to. Overlapping or highly displaced ribs need to be reduced and plated. And then the drains, we typically drain the thorax. The dreaded complication of the retained hemothorax, which then requires a VATS or a thoracotomy later, is looms large. And so we do whatever we can in the operating room to make sure that the pleural space is addressed. We either put the thoroscope in or we lavage the space with warm saline using a chest tube. And we want to ensure that that the hemothorax is completely evacuated. The skin flaps and submuscular flaps, we don't typically drain those. We used to, but we don't anymore. And skin closure techniques are pretty normal. These patients we no longer restrict them. That's not true of everyone. I'm giving you my technical bias. There are other institutions that do some of these things a little bit different, but in general, this is the course of action. We early mobilization, early out of bed, aggressive pulmonary toilet, some early physical therapy to maintain arm and shoulder mobility and to prevent scapular adhesion to the chest wall. Those things are thought to be very important. Some of them are being actively studied now. But what's particularly gratifying for these patients, particularly the flail chest patients, is watching their mechanics immediately improve. Their flail, their paradox goes away an hour later in the ICU. Their pain is much easier to control, and oftentimes they're ready for extubation then or the next day. And they tend to mobilize quickly, and many of them proceed rapidly to rehab their other injuries. That's another rationale for fixing patients with bad chest trauma in conjunction with lower extremity or pelvic trauma, is it's easier for them to to crutch, to weight bear with crutches in the subsequent weeks of recovery if their chest wall has been stabilized and repaired. So if you look aggressively, you can find lots of reasons to fix people. And, you know, it's interesting, but it's true that ribs have healed on their own for millennia or longer, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing to do. There's lots of things in medicine that we have left unattended, but we've learned over the years that it's better to fix those. We fix the face, we fix long bones, we fix, you know, a host of other fractures, arguably that aren't necessarily life or limb threatening, but we do it to enhance recovery and give the patient a better result. And I think it's time to start thinking about ribs in the same light. But of course, I'm heavily biased. I've been doing this now and talking about it and teaching about it and studying it for a decade. And so you'll have to excuse my obvious bias. I've drunk the Kool-Aid. Let's just say it that way.
Well, thank you very much for that overview. That was very thorough and very helpful for our listeners. So our final segment here is the final five. It's where we ask you some questions that for our audience to get to know you a little more personally. So our first question is there someone outside of medicine who's been influential in your life and your career?
Well, I think I'll go to my father. He left me too soon, but he was a very skilled pilot who was valued education. He was intellectually curious. He was profoundly supportive of me and my desire to be a physician. And I can't think of anybody who had more influence on me than my father.
Do you have a favorite movie? And if so, what is it and why?
I do have a favorite movie, and it's kind of silly, but I love the Lawrence of Arabia movie. It's just one of those epic cinematic experiences that every time I watch it, I find something new. I just find T.E. Lawrence's character to be so compelling. Against all odds, he did great things, and I just I would have to say that movie. If I stuck on a desert island with only one movie to watch, that's the one I'd bring.
Our next question is, during residency, what was your guilty pleasure snack?
I love beef, and a cheeseburger would oftentimes hit the spot when it was late at night or I was after a long weekend of call. I would have to say a cheeseburger. How's that?
Number four, if you were to compete in the Olympics, what event would you want to do?
I'd say men's downhill skiing, a skiing venue, skiing in the Winter Olympics.
And right now, if we were to grab your white coat, what would we find in or on it?
That's a great question. You'd find a name medallion that's a dear friend of mine gave me many years ago, and it's got a Southwestern theme to it with a piece of turquoise on it and my name engraved on it. I value that nameplate because of the friendship that signifies. My name would you'd find a blue Sharpie. A pen. That's the only kind of pen I ever write with. You'd find one of those in the pocket, and you might find some scattered change.
Well, Dr. White, thank you for sharing and answering all those questions, and thank you for joining us this afternoon. We appreciate all your input on this topic of rib plating and chest wall injury. And yeah, thank you once again.
Well, you're very welcome. I admire what you guys do.
Until next time, dominate the day.
Hey, wake up! New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at freestylelibre.us.
For prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
Hey, it's Austin James. Yes, I'm living with diabetes, but it doesn't have to define me. Thanks to the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor, I get real-time glucose readings throughout the day. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor is small and easy to wear, giving me the freedom to focus on my life as a parent and a musician. Now this is progress. You can get a free sensor at freestylelibre.us.
Offer available for people who qualify. Visit myfreestyle.us to see all terms and conditions. Certain exclusions apply. Data on file, Abbott Diabetes Care, for prescription only. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.